Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell. Episode 91, reported December 17th, 2010. Child's Play. This episode is brought to you by Squarespace.com, the fast and easy way to publish a high-quality website or blog. For a free trial and 10% off the lifetime of your new account, go to Squarespace.com and use TWiL, T-W-I-L, as your offer code. Hello, and welcome to episode 91 of This Week in Law. I'm Denise Howell, and I'm here today with a great panel of folks to talk about all those important issues in technology, privacy, and the internet, and the law. One of the great new panelists that we have this week with us is Mike Wood, the founder, if you have children, you know this man, you've used his products, of LeapFrog, the wonderful company that makes all kinds of children's learning products, and most recently, SmartyAnts.com. Hello, Mike.
Hi, Denise.
It's great to have you on the show. Mike is a recovering lawyer. we're excited to hear about how his legal background shades his life as an entrepreneur and creative mind in the technology world. We're also hoping to get Patrick Norton on with us today. We'll let you know if Patrick is actually able to join us. But in the meantime, we've got Evan Brown joining us. Hello, Evan.
Hey, how's it going?
Going great. Good to see you. Great to have you back. Good to see you too. Happy holidays.
Thanks. Same to you. It's great to be here.
That beard is coming in even more full.
That's right. It's beginning to look a lot like Christmas.
It is. It's indeed. All right. Mike, I would love to pick your brain for a bit about the business decisions surrounding technology products and services aimed at children. You are very well versed in that arena. You've made some choices over the years about data collection and business models, whether you were going to be ad-supported or subscription-supported. Can you clue us into your thought processes there and why you've chosen the various strategies you have?
Sure. I'll talk in the context of SmartyAnts because that's really the online portion of what I've done. Mm-hmm. And we made a conscious decision not to be ad-based. We market really to parents, not to kids. And of course, the data that we collect is really related only to how kids are progressing through our content. I mean, one of the most important things about what we're doing is that we're doing real-time assessments of these kids as they work their way from learning their ABCs all the way through the end of first grade reading. And the strength of what we've created is really based upon the ability to move kids at exactly the pace they're learning. So it's one of the really, I think, wonderful, empowering elements of the internet, and that is that we can completely personalize each child's learning track so that they're always within what's called the zone of proximate learning. There, we give them the next bit of content exactly when they're ready to learn it, so they're never bored, but they're never frustrated and never feel dumb. So to a certain, at least I feel as though it's one of the most powerful and in the long run important things that we're going to be able to do with the internet, that is in education, constantly know when kids are getting what we're giving them, constantly give them the ability to feel smart, and constantly give them the scaffolding or support they need when we detect that they're missing out on a concept, so that the train doesn't leave the station without them. They're always right in the middle of the train, and it's moving at their pace, sometimes faster, sometimes slower. We collect that data, but we, of course, don't share it with anyone. It is just between us and the kids' parents. And then it gets even more protected when we go into schools We don't get the data at all. It's all collected and maintained within the school's server database, so that data is just within the school system. So we've elected to be as private as we possibly can, collect only the data that is immediately necessary to help us make these products great for kids, and not share it to anyone. And we don't. We have virtual goods on the site, but we don't. They're earned on the site. They're not. We don't have kids ask their parents to buy things for them for the site, and we don't do any advertising on the site or to parents. So it's we try and be pure about that. I think it's important, particularly when we're trying to create something that's really about helping kids learn to read, that we not commercialize it. The drawback is that it's a subscription model. It's $50 a year, and in lots of ways that's a hurdle, but it's a conscious decision so that we don't have to do advertising and get involved in any of those issues.
Yeah, I was going to ask you how big a hurdle you think that is. Obviously, there are a lot of sites out there that have decided it's too big for them and that they're going to collect data and allow targeted ads in one way or another to their users, who oftentimes are below 18 or even 13 years old. Is this something that's a concern for you long term? Do you think that at some point you may have to rethink your strategy?
Well, it is certainly a hurdle. I mean, there's no question that free Trump's subscription, at least at first blush, and I suppose it's at the end of the day, it's really about the quality of the experience on the site. And, we think that this is, I look at it as a sort of a personalized tutor available for kids, all the way from the beginning of reading up to the end of first grade, available 24/7, and our subscription is $50 a year. So to me, it's a really a great bargain, and I'd really rather keep it that way than have a trade-off where, particularly in dealing with kids, that we get involved in any of the issues around data collection, which we really can't, or trying to commercialize this thing and having kids constantly asking their parents to buy products because that's part of the experience. It's just a decision that I've made and I'm sure we'll stick with it.
You were telling me something interesting before we started the show about doing a virtual social environment your kids' learning site. Explain that a little bit more. Why have a social aspect at all? And how have you tweaked it a bit to make it, a more safe, less risky environment for the kids?
Yeah. So the original idea on this was I spent quite a bit of time playing around with Club Penguin, and it's completely enchanting, and I love it because it's sort of the world's biggest, safest playground that kids can go to, and there's always people there to play with, and it's safe and nurturing and it's fun. And I thought, geez, if all these kids are spending all this time on Club Penguin and not really learning anything important, what if I could create a Club Penguin essentially for younger kids, where all the time they were on the site, they were on this great learning to read adventure? So that was the underlying concept of Smarty Ants. And I wanted to incorporate this concept of cooperative learning, where kids could play together and they could essentially be teaching each other because they were at different levels of learning, and it would be a fun interactive experience. So we developed a prototype of this. And in order to demonstrate it, we had to build artificial intelligent ants. The little kids' avatars are these little ants. And I wanted to be able to demonstrate the cooperative learning. So we built these little ants that could interact with the actual child's ants in a way that simulated a social site. And we tested it with 80 mothers. And we had lots of great feedback. They loved the idea. They loved this thing. They wanted to subscribe, et cetera, et cetera. And then at the end of each of the four focus groups, I said, "Are there any problems that you have with what we're doing? Because the only way we can make it better is if we know what parents are concerned about or kids don't like. And no. It's very hard to elicit negative feedback. And finally, one mom raised her hand. She said, you know, my 9-year-old is on Club Penguin. It's an open social site, but I'm really uncomfortable with 4, 5, or 6-year-old kids being on an open social site. And all of a sudden, essentially 79 other hands went up. And all of them virtually said, we would really prefer if this was not an open social site. So I said, what if we created a virtual social site where kids got to pick their friends? That is, at the very beginning, they get to pick different aunts, boy and girl aunts, and they get to name them after their friends. And then if all the time they play on the site, these friends of theirs interact with the kids, and the nice thing about it is that we can program these other aunts to have really good manners, please and thank you. They can play together on teams as good teammates, and we can really model good behavior so that it's not sort of arbitrary about what's going to happen. In fact, it's different. It's really positive things that you'd like in a group setting, and so that's what we've done, and it's. I must admit, there's something sort of thrilling about the unpredictability of these open sites. But on the other hand, when you're dealing with 4, 5, and 6-year-old kids, I think the trade-off to be able to model this really good behaviors is a positive one. But it's
so even if your child's friends are on Santa's naughty list, they're going to be on the nice list in the game.
Yeah, Santa likes all of the little ants on our our site because they're doing good things.
That is funny. Well, there you go. You don't have to deal with moderation and bullying in that kind of scenario then, I guess. But
the nice thing is that we can actually model the opposite behavior and in the long run, that's going to be, hopefully that'll be really powerful.
Evan, you think Mike has a right of publicity name and likeness problem? users' friends.
Well, yeah, that's interesting, isn't it? And it's intriguing what you just said there, Mike, about the ability to model the opposite behavior, because it would seem that there would be just as valuable lessons to come from that, than what there would in interacting with aunts who are always on their good behavior. So that you would have, certain characters that would develop a certain reputation, and it would be interesting to see the social dynamics develop around that, when there's all of these interactions with more problematic aspects of the human spirit, I guess.
Well, it's a great idea, and I hadn't thought of it. And of course, it'd be easy enough to do to have one of the little friends say something that hurt somebody else's feelings and have them talk about it. So anyway, there's lots of opportunities, and that would be a great one. I just remember, taking our son to play soccer, and he'd never passed the ball because he was always scoring, and I was trying to get him to pass the ball. And it's lots of times it's very hard for parents to influence these kids, but obviously their peers have a lot of influence, and if we can model good peer interaction, it might be a nice way for them to learn these sort of tough and important lessons in a playful way.
Sounds like it could be the core of a bad sci-fi story, though. The ant gone bad. Your AI sort of loses control, and there's a renegade Tron ant in the system.
Yeah, well, it's probably better that we think we have some control over the AI ants than knowing we don't have control over the open social ants.
Right. One thing that's interesting about your new endeavor, Smarty Ants, is that you have created all the characters, and unlike a lot of the LeapFrog products, are not relying yet at any rate on licensing any popular characters like Dora and the Star Wars world, which have made their way into the LeapFrog family of devices and products. Can you talk a bit about how difficult it is or expensive it is to incorporate those familiar characters into children's works? And is this something you've consciously avoided this time?
Yes. So my recollection is we generally paid a 10 to 12% royalty for using, popular Dora and SpongeBob type characters at LeapFrog. And of course, it's very seductive to become dependent upon licenses, because it gives instant credibility. There's a lot of great reasons it gives instant credibility, and so it's seductive to do that. We didn't do it. We wanted to have complete freedom over what our little ants do and the coach does, and we've got a camera bee and we've got a flea and we've got the pet dogs. And so that was a conscious decision that we've made. We've tried to give them personalities which we think are attractive and fun and engaging. And when you deal with layers and layers of licensing, the whole creative process becomes highly problematic. And we're trying to do a lot in a short period of time. And the ability to control and own our own characters was and is important to us. We do one thing that is important. I think we do a whole language part of our site where we've licensed from Candlewick Press some of what we believe are the great stories in children's literature, and kids get to go to that site. It's in the context of a story quiz show, and the stories are read to them because it's aspirational reading. It's beyond where most of these kids would be able to read it themselves. But then we ask questions about character, plot, and theme. So we're developing comprehension skills for kids, and we're introducing them to great literature, which makes them want to be able to read. We won't ever do this, but it's sort of like the Harry Potter effect, where hundreds of thousands of kids learn to become better readers because they wanted to read Harry Potter. Well, the concept of taking young kids and exposing them to great children's literature is highly motivating.
That's great. Hey, Burke's going to show a quick shot of Smarty Ants so that people can see what we're talking about. There it is. If you've got kids, go check it out. If they're in the 4 to 6 range, we've played around with it a bit. It's quite nice and really a nice way to, I can see why schools would like to use it, because kids can really move at their own pace through a learning process. I really love the idea of incorporating gaming and learning in a productive way, and not always looking at video games as something that's, a distraction or counter to what parents want their kids to do. So this is a really nice throwing up of usual expectations in that regard. So thank you, Mike, for providing that service for all us parents out there.
Thank you, Denise.
And for making those really, I think, smart and parent-friendly choices about what's going on with the data. Because obviously, how your children are progressing, what they're doing, where they are on a learning scale, in addition to all their personal data, of course, is some of the most sensitive information I can think of. So it's good to know that you're taking that very seriously. The Obama administration would like lots of other companies to follow your lead, Mike, because just in the last couple of days, we've had an announcement that the Obama administration would like us to have a privacy bill of rights and a privacy policy office. So there are a bunch of recommendations in a report released by the Commerce Department just yesterday, Thursday. Evan, what do you think about this? Is this something that we need in this country? Or are we moving more toward the European model of privacy policy and enforcement?
It's almost as if everybody can recognize the momentum building in the public consciousness now of the importance of some more systematic, broad-reaching activity to govern consumer privacy. I mean, we've seen the report from the FTC that came out a couple of weeks ago. Now we've got the Commerce Department talking about it. I mean, these are two different parts of the government. We've talked so much about industry efforts to recognize the importance of this and to implement good procedures and policies so that, maybe ostensibly the government will stay out of this type of regulation. So, it's getting to the point now where clearly something something is going to happen. And all the different approaches seem nuanced, you know, with the Commerce Department kind of operating in its little part of the executive branch. And then, with there's also legislative rumblings about all this. It seems really likely we're going to see something. And I imagine that it's going to be something that closely resembles the European model of it being much more, I guess it's easier to say it, much less of a patchwork of privacy regulations, much something much more uniform across the board. I think that we'll see an amalgamation of these various different initiatives and efforts and ways of articulating things come into one thing, probably some legislation that hopefully is not so, hopefully doesn't specifically mention cookies. That way it won't become technologically out of date and or anachronistic too soon, but somehow has a smarter way of managing all of this stuff. Don't you think we'll see something? I mean, it's just like the water building up behind the dam. Eventually something's got to give here. We're going to see something.
Yeah, I think we will. I mean, there is so much talk about, you know, draft bills, and it's all bound up with who can get what through Congress right now. But I do think that we will see something out there that gets momentum behind it and support in a bipartisan way, because, you know, it's hard to argue with a whole lot of what's at stake here. You know, people, their information is more and more available. It's being collected. It's more and more valuable in various ways. And yet it's more and more out of their control. So, you know, I think that causes a lot of sleepless nights for folks. And Congress likes to respond to that sort of thing. Mike, as an entrepreneur, are you concerned about the government getting more involved in these areas? Would you prefer that it be left to the discretion of folks like yourself to make good or bad decisions about what's done with people's data?
I think that we're probably better off if we have a single piece of legislation that is easy to understand, that creates obligations of transparency, that is, what data is being collected, how it's being used, and giving consumers clear choice to opt in or opt out with that knowledge. And I think otherwise we're going to have increasing incidents of people being surprised about what was being collected and how it's being used, and it casts a dark cloud over all of us. And I think we're really better off if there is some general law regulations implemented so that all of us know what's being collected, all of us know how it's being used, and all of us have the ability based on that information to make decisions about what we want to allow people to collect and how we want to let them use it. So I think in the long run that sort of transparency and choice at the consumer level with really clear guidelines, it probably in the long run creates a better opportunity for people like, for all of us entrepreneurs or business people. And so that's what I think.
Well, Dan Tynan over at IT World has a proposal for Congress. He calls it the HPPA, the Honest Privacy Policy Act. And it would require every company to post a simple, direct, and brutally honest policy detailing what really happens to your data. And he has kindly provided one of his own that is really funny. You folks need to go check it out. It's in our delicious discussion points at delicious.com/thisweekinlaw/91. The first truly honest privacy policy is the name of his post. And he says things, you know, in his model privacy policy, which he has open sourced. If anybody wants to go ahead and adopt this, he asks only for a credit and a link back. Things like, we store this information an indefinite amount of time for reasons we even don't fully understand. And when we do eventually get around to deleting it, you can bet it's still kicking around on some network backup drives in somebody's closet. So once we have it, there's really no getting it back. Hell, we can't even find our keys half the time. How do you expect us to keep track of this stuff?
Yeah, and it's also archived in a torrent file somewhere that's already been distributed to 1,000 different places on the web too. You know, like with the which was it that just this past week, you know, that hack, that was it Gawker? that had all the user information, you know, usernames and passwords and stuff, you know, gotten into. And then, you know, but I mean, that, of course, was no action on the part of Gawker's part. It was just, you know, the nefarious activities of others. But, you know, still, once it's out there, and it's there's no getting it back in a lot of situations. So, but one thing that really concerns me under a lot of this stuff, I mean, this is really funny, you know, the tongue in cheek, you know, attitude toward all of this, but, you know, are we, you know, if there is more transparency and people learn about how their data is used and how it's collected and what companies are doing with it. And, you know, even if those companies know about it or not, you know, are we going to, you know, live long enough to regret there being more transparency and more openness and there actually being more knowledge on the part of the end users? Maybe to a certain extent, ignorance is bliss. And I'm just being really speculative about this. I'm not trying to endorse a particular, you know, position from this. I'm just kind of talking. But, you know, don't we get a lot of benefit as users with, you know, in the form of a lot of free stuff, you know, in return for disclosing a lot of information about ourselves and maybe it being used in ways that we don't know about? But, you know, for the most part, most of us, I guess, if we have been harmed by that, we don't know it yet. I mean, just think of it this way. Think about how gosh darn expensive it must be to operate Facebook. You know, think of the bandwidth costs, the storage, you know, the team of lawyers that they have to keep on staff to handle, you know, the requests that come in. You know, I mean, just think about how expensive it must be to operate a site like Facebook. Well, you know, that wouldn't be, you know, possible to operate that unless there was, you know, extremely detailed and broad data collection going on and use of it in a certain way. This is just one example. I mean, this would apply to any platform across the web. If we pull back on all of that stuff, are we going to regret the fact that there isn't going to be as much free stuff available to us out there as widely available? Am I overstating it, or is it is there any concern that we should have about that?
I don't think you're overstating it. Go ahead, Mike.
I think in the long run, this sort of ignorance is bliss policy generally doesn't work. But I do think that people, we should all realize if we want to be on Facebook, we should know exactly what's being done and probably have an alternative. If you consent to having this data collected and shared, this is all free. And if you don't, this is what it's going to cost you when you opt in or out. And I think that policy will create a most enlightened approach to where the happy medium is between what people are willing to have collected and shared and warrant a free subscription and those things that are so important that shouldn't be shared that people don't want or they pay a subscription price for that. But I think the marketplace almost always works out well when the information is freely traded. And I think in the long run, we will still have Facebook. I'm sure we will. And the way they treat in general data collection and sharing might be modified somewhat to keep the vast majority of this free. And for those people who think that isn't the right medium solution for them, they can always opt out and pay a subscription. So I my guess is in the long run that works out better for everyone.
I usually drop our resource and tip of the week at the end of the show, but I'm going to do the resource now since it's right in line with what we're discussing. Catherine Noyes at PC World did a post called How the FTC's Do Not Track Idea May Affect Your Site. And she's getting into some very practical notions around what we're describing. You know, if you're not able to target ads, she says, for example, the revenue implications are fairly obvious. Advertisers may end up having to pay more for impressions across a more diverse set of websites, while publishers may have to begin charging for content. And another good comment she has here, since consumers' participation is voluntary, there's nothing to say that businesses couldn't offer them new incentives to make non-participation more attractive. Non-participation in Do Not Track, that's sort of double negative, but if you can follow what she's saying there, to allow sites to collect data despite Do Not Track. Those who don't participate would likely already be receiving more tailored advertising and content, but advertisers and publishers could make that prospect even more compelling with discounts, perks, or other enticements that would go a long way toward increasing loyalty as well. So as all of this shakes out, you know, we may wind up in kind of a two-tiered universe where some people are opting out of being tracked altogether. Some, maybe there's a middle level of, you know, some tracking in exchange for a more tailored personalized experience. And maybe there's just, you know, I'm all in, I don't care what you know about me. So we'll have to see what that goes, where that goes. But this post about how it affects your site, I think is nice and practical for folks out there who are trying to navigate these waters. And right now I want to take a break and thank our sponsor, Squarespace. After the break, Evan, I'd love to have you explain about Twitter squatting and WikiLeaks remedies, if you would.
Right on.
But before we get to that, I do want to thank Squarespace for sponsoring the show. This episode of Twill is brought to you by Squarespace, which is the fast and easy way to publish a high-quality website or blog. What we have with Squarespace is an easy-to-use UI for creating and managing a website or blog. It does not have an automatic privacy policy generator, but you know, you can always come to Twill for ideas about that. What it does have is great designs for both beginners and CSS experts. You can tweak and modify these sites however you'd like, from the most basic to the most wild and crazy thing. You've got hundreds of design templates, and if you'd like to customize but you are not a CSS expert, it's all drag and drop and really fantastic and simple to use. The all-inclusive service, for starting at about $12 a month, includes several modules to build your website. There's a blog module, a forum, a form builder. There's Flickr photo display, where you can choose a thumbnail or a slideshow view. There's a Twitter widget. In fact, the integration with all the social sites is really excellent. There's Google Maps and more. And their statistics and search engine tweaks are fantastic too. There's permission access handling. And of course, their cloud architecture is designed so that these sites are rock solid. I'm not sure exactly what they're doing behind the scenes, but we've tried here at Twit to bring down Squarespace sites and we haven't been successful yet, despite all the efforts of the Twit army. And I host my blog on Squarespace and it's, you know, rock solid up all the time. I just love it and love using Squarespace. One thing I particularly enjoy is the iPhone app, where you can log into your website and update it on the go from anywhere. You should use Squarespace for all your website needs. Build it, host it, and update it anytime. And if you do decide to give it a try, there's no credit card needed. Just try it out, build your site, see what you think. And if you do decide to purchase, use the offer code TWIL, T-W-I-L, and get 10% off the lifetime of your new account. That's squarespace.com and use T-W-I-L as your offer code. So Evan, we have talked before about people's identities getting somewhat misappropriated on Twitter based on the fact that anyone can sign up and register whatever Twitter name they'd like. There was an interesting development there. You want to clue us in?
Right. We spend a lot of time, you know, thinking about this and kind of hypothesizing as to what the real trademark implications might be or the identity implications might be from, you know, what we call Twitter squatting. And there's not been a lot of activity in the courts when it comes to this point. But there was a little case that came out of the Eastern District of New York. What was it, last week? It was December 6th that came out. It was some litigation between it was the airport, the local airport authority. I guess it was the town of Islip, New York, with the Long Island Airport there, was involved in a cyber squatting dispute with I think it was a developer who had registered some domain names, and they'd actually been involved in some UDRP litigation, you know, domain name dispute proceedings under the Uniform Domain Name Dispute Resolution Policy. But anyway, it ended up in federal court. And the real essence of the matter dealt with these domain names. But there was this, there was also this portion of the case that dealt with the fact that the bad guys here, or the alleged bad guys, and they were actually the plaintiffs. It gets a little bit confusing because it was a declaratory judgment action where the alleged infringers were suing the ones who had accused them of infringement. So when I say it was the plaintiffs who had who were enjoined against using these Twitter names, it's a little bit confusing, but that's actually what happened there. The court entered an injunction against the plaintiffs in this declaratory judgment action, among other things, to stop them from using certain Twitter handles that were associated with the trademarks of the local airport authority. And so the importance of this is that the court treated those identities and those ability and the ability of those monikers, those username, those handles on Twitter to be a source identifier in a trademark sense, just in the same way that it does a domain name or a trademark in general. So even though the Twitter aspect of this case was, a relatively small portion of the decision, it stands for the proposition that the courts are willing to recognize Twitter as Twitter usernames as source identifying things, subject to the protection of the trademark laws, the Lanham Act, and will enter orders governing how they shall be used. So that's what happened in this case. The alleged infringers, are prohibited under this court order from using these Twitter handles until the pendency of the litigation. See how it all turns out. So I thought that was an interesting observation to make. That's why I wrote up a little piece about that case.
Yeah, it's sort of an acknowledgement that even though these aren't, under the vast body of domain name law technically, yet they're going to be treated that way by the courts from time to time, and it seems like that's what's gone on here.
Right, because it's not clear. A couple of years ago, before Twitter was so much in everybody's mind like this, and before it was more than just a handful, so to speak, of people who recognized the power there to communicate. I don't know that a court would have recognized a Twitter username to have this power of really designating mm-hmm. source and designating the place where communications are coming from.
All right, one other thing to explore with you, Evan, and that is remedies for folks who have been subject to a WikiLeaks-type leak. Are there any, and are they meaningful?
Well, there's a radical shift here, and I wrote this post. It seems like I did everything a couple weeks ago, right? There's that, just as an aside, there's that scene from Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, where they're talking about everything is two weeks away. It's like, well, isn't this a geographical anomaly? You're 2 weeks from everything. So I'm just saying, a couple of weeks ago, I wrote this up. I digress. I was thinking about WikiLeaks and just, the fact that it's out there. There are all these mirror sites. There's this insurance file that's allegedly been downloaded maybe 100,000 times. This is the one that's still encrypted. And, there's this rumor that if Julian Assange is put away or killed, or if something happens to WikiLeaks, the encryption key will be released. And, there's this information that's just out there in such a radical sense that we can't even begin to get our minds around it. And what precipitated my thoughts along these lines was something I read about the State Department's demand to WikiLeaks at one point that all the documents be returned, and how silly that is, and how actually the State Department kind of embarrassed itself by making that demand because it's just so out there. All this information is out there, and it continues to be perpetuated as the newspapers like El País and Le Monde and others are releasing these things. So I got to thinking about how, this really applies in a practical sense, because all of the discussions we have about WikiLeaks are at this very high abstract level of national security and the First Amendment freedom of the press and all of that stuff. Matters that as a practicing lawyer, I don't really, to be honest with you, I don't deal with every day. My clients are people who are actually out there doing business, developing platforms, people who are concerned about their individual rights of privacy and all of this stuff. So I got to thinking, really, what does it mean for us to be thinking about these things? What can we learn?
What can you ask for that actually makes sense and is not out there in every conceivable sense of the phrase?
You're right. And so I don't really have a good answer to any of these questions. But I mean, there's this central thesis that I have that should guide us in rethinking the kind of remedies have. And that is, you know, to the extent that technology permits us, you know, that reasonably available to technology permits us to have information that's radically distributed, there's a greater, you know, obviously there's a greater potential for harm when information is disclosed in a way that's not authorized. And so we've really just got to you know, rethink the way that we can fashion remedies for these things. And perhaps it's that these remedies are so effective, or the traditional remedies we have, like an injunction against somebody further disclosing information, are so ineffectual that may actually hop over and somehow greater magnify the question of liability. You know, is it inherently, I almost said inherently badder, is it inherently worse, you know, to release data like WikiLeaks has, knowing that it will be propagated very quickly and very effectively? Like, say, if you knowingly put something out on BitTorrent, is that inherently worse? Should that be treated in a greater sense of culpability, enhanced liability for doing that, rather than just, you know, making a photocopy of something and handing it over to the reporter at the local newspaper? No answers, just kind of a real fundamental question I saw on that point. You know, what does it mean for an individual's right when there is this ability for information to be radically distributed?
Great. Well, thank you for raising that and thinking about it in a practical way, as I'm sure that everyone who might be subject to this kind of thing would hope that their lawyers could do. What I want to toss out to you guys before we wrap the show, since we're coming into the end of the year, is, Mike, we'll start with you. What do you think was the most important or significant technology law-related development in 2010?
Boy, I'm the wrong person to ask, Denise, because I spent so much of the year worrying about how to build the content and launch mm-hmm. Smarty Ants.
So no burning issues around, I don't know, copyright law or how media gets distributed or journalism, or building a site aimed at kids that comes to mind?
No.
All right. Well, I appreciate the efforts that you have spent this year in coming up with something that's going to be a great tool for all the kids out there in the 4 to 6 age range. Evan, how about you? Any issues that sort of stick out in your mind from 2010?
It's been an interesting year for the First Amendment, and that's taken a couple of different flavors. Generally, I think there's been some interesting stuff to happen with anonymity in the defamation context we've seen, but particularly with you know, some of the new brand of file sharing cases that have been filed against BitTorrent users for trading movies. So I think there's a big issue there. That's actually more than just a First Amendment issue, but it's the issue of all that, of this discovery of anonymous people on a mass scale. Sometimes there are anonymity concerns. Sometimes there are practical concerns that go into that. The other big thing under the First Amendment, this harkens back to the middle part of the year, was Craigslist's decision to take off the adult services portion of its site, and, you know, did it rather defiantly, being censored there. So those are the things that have captured my attention the most during the year, you know, broadly under this notion of, you know, saying stuff on the internet, which I guess, you know, covers a lot of what we talk about, but, you know, focused the analysis and thoughts about those things focused on those particular nuanced kinds of issues there. That's what I've enjoyed the most in 2010.
Yeah, I think for me, it's been just a constant further progression down the line of tools that make it easy for folks to do things without asking permission about it. Twitter has really come into its own this year and has been a tool that, you know, Evan, you and I have been blogging for a long time. And back in the early days of blogging, we talked about how it democratized access to global communications. But I think, you know, Twitter really takes that and makes it so accessible, you can hardly avoid using the service. So
yes,
sort of blogging for everybody. And that's come with its share of interesting consequences. You know, we keep seeing stories about judicial proceedings being disrupted by people participating in them having and using their Twitter access. The workplace is disrupted by it. The entertainers are speaking their minds without any kind of handling or filtering through their staffs of people. So it's I think something that's kind of a hallmark of our age, that all the areas where we're used to there being control and filters in place are really breaking down, and that it applies to the world of media and creation. Mike, of course, is not your run-of-the-mill entrepreneur. He's a serial creator of great products for kids. So this is not his first rodeo on along these lines. But, you know, when Mike decides he's got a great idea and he's going to implement it, there's not a whole lot standing in his way. And that goes for a lot of other people out there, too. And for us here at Twit, creating a way with our shows and getting them into really thousands and thousands of people's hands without needing to ask permission of any kind of media conglomerate or distribution chain. So I like all that. I think it's really encouraging. I think that there are some countervailing forces, you know, with net neutrality becoming perhaps a more scarce commodity, and also with devices becoming more locked down, and the universe of what you can do with them being deproved. If you've ever heard Leo's interview with Steve Martin elsewhere on the Twit network, I love that term, deprovement, as our devices get less complicated, easier to use in some ways, but also less functional in others. So that's kind of what I think about when I think about 2010. I also think about the great work that the folks at EFF continue to do, slogging along, and that's going to be our tip of the week. But the upshot is there was a criminal case where, and in fact, it was a criminal fraud prosecution of the folks who make Enzyte, which is a male enhancement product that if you've ever been watching TV very late at night, you have seen their really hysterical ads. Anyway.
Smiling Bob, right?
Yeah, Smiling Bob, exactly. There was an issue in their case about the government being able to access email without a subpoena, and there wound up being an exception in the case, a good faith exception that meant, in fact, they could in this particular case. But the holding of the case is that there is a reasonable expectation of privacy in the same way as there is for regular mail and telephone calls, that users are going to expect that if those records are going to be accessed by the government, there's going to be a subpoena involved and the Fourth Amendment applies. So that's our tip of the week, that if you think the government is trying to look at your accounts, you should demand that there be a subpoena involved, or invoke this Sixth Circuit case and at least think about whether the proper T's have been crossed and I's dotted to get access to that information. And with that, any parting thoughts from you, Mike? It's been great having you on the show.
Yeah, great to be on. Thank you very much, and happy holidays and happy new year.
You too. Really enjoyed chatting with you, and I will be sure and say hi to my dad, Mel.
Yeah, thank you very much.
I will. And so, of course, folks can find your new endeavor at smartyants.com. Anything else you want to plug before we say goodbye?
No, we try to create something. We have created something that that I believe, my big concern was these 30% of kids or so that graduate from the first grade and aren't not reading at first grade level. Mm-hmm. And I thought a lot about how to try and solve it. And I think the answer is to get those kids involved in a program when they're four, and help them learn the sounds and how they make words, et cetera, et cetera. So it's, you know, I think it's a wonderful spot for parents and kids to spend time and have a lot of fun, but also learn something profoundly important and not get to the point where they're behind and the whole thing sort of becomes a lot more difficult.
Absolutely. And as the parent of a first grader, I have special appreciation for the hard work you've done and the service you've launched. So really great chatting with you today.
Thank you, Evan, very much. Thanks for including me.
Our pleasure. Evan, always Wonderful to have you on the show. Any last thoughts before we wrap our second to last show of the year?
Well, same here. It's always a great time. I really love being on the show. Thanks for having me back. And just wanted to let you know, Mike, really, really great talking to you. I've been looking forward to, you know, meeting you here. I've got a 5-year-old and a 3-year-old at home, and, you know, we love your stuff. And so, you know, they've been very excited the fact that I was going to be talking with you today. So it's really been wonderful. Thank you.
Well, and I've been very glad to be on the show with you also, Evan. Thanks. And good luck with the kids. I envy both of you having a 3-year-old, a 5-year-old, and a first grader. Those are magic years. So I envy you. It sounds like fun.
Sure thing. Yes. Thank you.
All right. So with that, we're going to wrap episode 91 of This Week in Law. And if you're watching live, stay tuned because we're going to go right into episode 92. Take care.